queer life in Montreal was wild.
Montreal in the 90s was a great time, but it had a dark side.
It was not a safe city for gay people back then.
But what else was behind a series of deaths in the city?
Somebody's killing gay men. We want to know why.
I'm Francis Plourde, and this is The Village, The Montreal Murders. Get early access to episodes at cbc.ca/listen or by subscribing to the CBC True Crime Premium channel on Apple Podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
Hey, I'm Alamin Abdul-Mahmoud. We are at the midpoint of President Joe Biden's first 100 days in office. And last week, Biden had his biggest moment yet. That was the passage of a $1.9 trillion COVID-19 relief bill. It is one of the largest expansions of federal social support in the U.S. in decades, and it brings aid to tens of millions of people. But another area where President Biden has promised to distinguish himself from his predecessor, the immigration file, it is proving difficult. A comprehensive immigration reform bill that he introduced has been pushed to the back burner as Democrats try to drum up enough support, even within their ranks, for it to pass. An increasing number of migrant children are arriving at the U.S.-Mexico border, leaving border officials scrambling to find adequate shelter and deal with measures introduced by President Trump that have yet to be overturned. For more on this, we've got Kadia Goba, a Congress reporter for Axios, and freelance journalist Tanvi Misra, who covers immigration in Washington, D.C. You're listening to Party in the USA. Let's get into it. Thanks for coming on the show, Kadia and Tanvi. I'm really excited to talk to you today.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.
Okay, we got to, of course, start with the big COVID-19 relief bill. President Biden signed this $1.9 trillion bill into existence.
Shots in arms and money in pockets. That's important. The American Rescue Plan is already doing what it was designed to do, make a difference in people's everyday lives.
It is massive, right? It brings federal aid to millions of Americans. It's meant to deal with the economic devastation that COVID-19 has left behind. And checks have been arriving as early as this past weekend. Kadia, can you just walk us a bit through the benefits of this bill?
Sure. Well, there's a moratorium on rent, which a lot of people were super excited about. As you mentioned, the $1,400 checks, there is a cap. What people are super excited about is more children get the benefit, right? So some families will get over $4,000 depending on the situation and the ages of the children. And what I thought was interesting was the amount of money that went towards obviously vaccines, right? But then there was like there are going to be programs towards vaccine hesitancy, right? Which we see especially in like communities of color, and now more recently, white Republicans aren't taking the vaccine. So I think that's super important because to kill the virus or to like make this thing go away, a lot of people apparently need convincing around taking the vaccine. So super important there.
I gotta tell you, I cannot relate because I so desperately want this vaccine that I'm gonna go on a mission to convince others to take it just because I'm so excited to. So I cannot, you know, process vaccine hesitancy, but of course I understand that it's a thing. We also gotta talk about this child tax credit, Kadia, because it's been expanded up to $3,600 per child. What is going on there? What does that do?
So it contributes to like child care services. Remember there, that was a big issue for people staying at home. So it helps there. What people don't recognize is or appreciate that a lot of children or college age students are like home from school, right? And there's like food plan services. Like people were getting this extra money, but then their children didn't see the benefit because there were added on expenditures, right, that schools provided and that parents then had to take up. So I think people, especially around like school lunches and stuff like that. So I think people were super appreciative of that.
Now, Tanvi, Biden and Vice President Kamala Harris They hit the road immediately after the passage of this bill. They are advertising basically all the benefits that are coming to everybody. How has that been going? How has this bill been received by the public?
Well, what this bill does have, which, you know, I cover immigration policy, so, you know, has been, I've been hearing chatter about this, is that it does cover mixed status families. That means families with, you know, who filed jointly within perhaps an undocumented spouse. So, you know, one of the partners was either a U.S. citizen or a permanent resident, and then the other one was undocumented. Those types of families were not included in the previous COVID aid measures. And so that has been really exciting for many advocates. They've been pushing for that. What this bill still does not cover, though, is families where both adults are undocumented. And so what I've been hearing more and more of is, you know, a push at state level to kind of try to cover for that gap. But yeah, this is still, you know, a step in the right direction, many advocates say, just in terms of getting, you know, many of these undocumented workers, you know, many of them who work in essential jobs, essential careers, you know, delivery people and in agriculture and all of these different kinds of careers that have been very, very important with the, you know, we've come to realize really essential within the scope of the pandemic. So, so this has been, you know, something that's been exciting for people.
I think one thing to also contextualize all of this is that Joe Biden was around in 2009 when the Obama administration rolled out a massive stimulus bill during that financial collapse.
I've been here before. When President Obama and I came to office in 2009, he put me in charge of implementing the Recovery Act, which helped us recover and rebuild during the Great Recession.
And essentially what happened was Obama gave a lot of space for Republicans to define that stimulus bill on their terms. It was among the many reasons why we got the Tea Party movement. And I think that's pretty interesting to compare that to this moment, because it seems like Biden and Harris are kind of proactively going out there and saying, okay, this is what this bill is. This is what it's about. And so it gives a little bit less room for Republicans to define it. And so under that context, Kadia, how have Republicans responded to this giant bill?
So it's funny you say that. Yeah, and it's important to recognize this tour that he's doing is to do exactly that, right? Some of the criticism has been that Democrats don't take enough pride, or they don't take the credit for the plans that they do. And pointedly so, you just referred to what happened during the Obama era. I think it's interesting to see D-Trip doing the same thing, hashing up, distributing a bunch of videos for frontliners, right, to convince their constituent base that, hey, you know, no matter what Republicans say about this, this is a good thing. This benefits you. Now, to pivot over to Republicans, there's a mix, right? We already see certain Republicans taking credit for it, which I thought was very interesting. There was a big trend on Twitter saying you voted against it. Lily Salazar was one of the people who, like, lauded a bill that she got in the proposed or in the COVID relief plan, but she voted against it. But in general, as we know, Republicans wholly did not vote in favor of the coronavirus bill. So they're spinning it in a way that seems that there was too much pork, or there was too much added stuff in the bill. Only a certain small amount was directly contributing to the coronavirus relief. So that's the way Republicans have been spinning it.
But can you walk me through this? Because this sounds a little bit absurd. So we know that Republicans voted against this bill, and yet you have people like GOP Florida House Representative Maria Salazar tweeted that she was so proud of this bipartisan COVID relief bill. She voted against it. How, like, I guess, like, that is just so beyond me in terms of what you can take credit for. What are the limits of politics? But that just seems like a very easily disprovable hypothesis. You said no to this bill, and yet here you are taking credit for it. How does this even work?
Yeah, I mean, it's a spin, right? It's, remember, I think we should appreciate that many people listen to and watch news in a silo, right? So if you are a constituent of Salazar and you see this, right, you're like, oh, okay, this makes sense. She's doing something for us. But we all know if you're on Twitter and you see the responses to Twitter, a lot of people kind of debunk the idea that she should at all take credit. And to your question, it makes no sense.
That is a relief, because Tenvi, I thought there's something wrong with me, because like, as far as I know, you take credit for the bills that you're involved in. But let's talk a little bit about, who this bill is for, because the way the Democrats have positioned it, they positioned it as like something that all Americans need in this moment in the pandemic. Is that messaging working, do you think, Tenvi?
I think it's working for their base, which I do think, you know, just to Kadia's point, it's kind of interesting sort of the evolution of the reaction or the conversation among Republicans around this bill. I do think that their issues with the bill, they seem to be very loud about them. And then once it passed, you know, they know that their constituents may be benefited from the provisions within this bill. So I do think that's playing into now their calculus to spin, as Kadia mentioned, rewrite the history of their involvement in this bill. But I do think that the bill has a lot of progressive measures that that really do play to Biden's base. And so I do think that, you know, that messaging is being heard to a large extent. There are obviously problems, and there are people that think that the bill didn't go far enough. And so that tension is certainly also playing out, I feel like, as with many other measures with this one as well.
So we're going to take a pause right there, and when we come back, we'll talk immigration. Okay.
Queer life in Montreal was wild.
Montreal in the 90s was a great time, but it had a dark side.
It was not a safe city for gay people back then.
But what else was behind a series of deaths in the city?
Somebody's killing gay men. We want to know why.
I'm Francis Poord, and this is The Village, The Montreal Murders. Get early access to episodes at cbc.ca/listen or by subscribing to the CBC True Crime Premium channel on Apple Podcasts.
I want to switch gears here and talk immigration with the two of you, because immigration is one of those really polarizing political topics in the U.S. And so far, you know, Biden and his administration, they promised to overhaul a lot of the policies that Donald Trump brought in.
Process here that is humane, that is moral, that considers applications for refugees, applications for people to come to this country.
You know, pieces of evidence they've offered for this is, you know, they've lifted the ban on travelers from Muslim countries. They've halted the construction of the border wall. Biden's also introduced the U.S. Citizenship Act of 2021. It's the first major immigration reform bill since President Reagan's in 1986. That is a long time. Tenvi, briefly, what does this bill entail?
Yeah. So this bill is a comprehensive immigration reform bill, which means it has all sorts of measures designed to basically just, completely make the system anew. One of the central pillars of the bill is it lays out a process for legalization the hundreds and thousands of undocumented people in the country already. As long as they entered before January 1st, 2021, they'll have an access to a pathway to citizenship, which they did not have before. Apart from that, it, you know, puts in more protections for immigrant workers. There are a number of different work visas, and there have been complaints about how they tend to kind of disempower workers. They're at the mercy in certain ways of their employers, because their status is dependent on their employers to a large extent. And so there's measures to beef that up. There's also measures to resolve the massive backlog in family-based and employment-based legal immigration. This has been a problem for a long time. For example, people from India who have a green card have to wait for decades often to actually get from that point to the next point in the citizenship process. And that's because there's a huge backlog, and the system was put in place in 1965, and that, you know, it hasn't kind of updated how people apply from which countries and to what, like, what numbers of people apply. So that's something that they want to kind of revamp as well.
So Kadia, right now, not only do Republicans not support it, but not even all Democrats are on board with this bill. Is there any chance of it getting passed?
That's a great question. From the people I talked to on the Hill, it's a very slim chance that this is going to happen. What I'm hearing from sources and lawmakers who are willing to go on the record is that the DREAM Act will pass and the Farm Modernization Bill will pass separately. And then there's some rumblings about essential workers, some reform around essential workers going into this next big bill, which will be infrastructure. But there is not a lot unless there are certain items taken away. There hasn't been a big positive response, particularly around moderate Dems in the House on the president's legislation.
Mm-hmm. Now, the administration has already started to sort of turn its attention towards narrower pieces of legislation. So there's the 2021 American Dream and Promise Act, and then there's a Farm Workforce Modernization Act. Tanvi, both of those are set to pass this week. You call them unicorns. Why is that?
I call them unicorns because they're sort of narrow pieces of legislation within sort of the immigration landscape, legislative landscape, where there is some amount of bipartisan agreement and support for these measures. The Farm Workforce Modernization Act was actually introduced on a bipartisan basis in the House. And so Republicans tend to be more involved in these types of measures, farm worker measures, also because there are many of them come from states where agriculture is a huge industry. And so this is of, you know, utmost importance to them. That's about the Farm Work Modernization Act. But the Dream and Promise Act, that one specifically deals with the population that often is called the Dreamers, which is these are young people now, probably in their 20s and 30s. Some of them have kids. You know, they've lived in America their entire life, but they came here as children, and they've never had papers, basically. So they're, you know, the way that they're sort of framed is that they're American in every other way, but that their papers don't reflect that. And so they've been, pushing for legislation like this since 2001. And so they have really gone a long way in gaining support among the American public. I mean, polls have shown time and time again that there's actually a lot of bipartisan support among voters for this population, that they should get some sort of pathway to citizenship. And so that, you know, again, in terms of at least voters, there is some support for this bill on both sides of the aisle. Now, of course, that doesn't mean that they have clear pathways. I think there's a lot of optimism that both of these will have enough support in the Senate. They're going to the House floor this week. We'll see. I think what ends up happening often is that some of the more right-leaning Republicans will often want to tack on border security and other types of or restrictive measures to some of these bills. And then that conversation gets kind of bogged down. I've seen this happen before in the Dream and Promise Act debates that happened in the last Congress. And that's what kind of, you know, ties the bill down and kind of doesn't let it get the kind of overwhelming kind of ovation that that it would have otherwise, or you would have thought it would have got, you know. So right. The politics essentially get in the way.
So all of this is also taking context in this larger story, which is that there's been an increase of asylum seekers at the U.S.-Mexico border.
are coming regardless. The U.S. Border Patrol reports a surge in migrants since Biden won office, many of them children traveling without parents. That's led to the reopening.
Axios reported that there's been an average of 321 kids being referred to migrant shelters each day. Some of the stories that we're seeing over the past few days is that Border Patrol is going to have to build essentially like a new emergency shelter for unaccompanied immigrant children, because as of this past weekend, there were about 4,200 children in custody at Border Patrol. So, and they say that like the facilities for those are just like not enough for all those children. Kadia, there's this idea that's floating around that, you know, because migrants think Biden's administration has more lenient border policies, there's just been this greater increase. And you broke the story about GOP House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy. He went down to the border to evaluate the crisis himself. What is happening there?
I mean, chances are this is going to be a big political move, right? That Republicans are the first to visit the border, right? Outside of any congressional members of Congress. I think it's interesting that this was a very partisan venture. I spoke to Rep. Escobar. She was very clear that they did not ask her or like even talk to her, invite her to go, even though it literally is her district that they're visiting. So we will hear, and we already know, right? Like Republicans have already held press conferences outside of the Capitol building with signage that says Biden's border crisis. And I've talked to many staffers who, and you know, to ask them, is this going to be a moving issue, ongoing issue, I should say, until the upcoming midterms? And their response is, well, yeah, we're going to hold the president accountable. And yeah, that could very well be up until 2022. So I think we're going to constantly hear this. And I mean, let's not forget, this is something that Democrats actually ran on themselves a few years ago. So it poses for a different dynamic. But the bottom line is these are families that need placement or need to be situated. And it's sad that that is being overshadowed by the politics, or that will likely be overshadowed by the politics that is about to ensue.
Now, Tevye, there is also this reality that there were also spikes in terms of people at the border during the highest restrictions of Trump's presidency. So it's not just really about this perception that Joe Biden is more open to immigration. That's not everything that's going on here. What else is going on? What are the other reasons that people might be making the trek north?
Yeah, you know, it's always really frustrating for me to, when I cover this issue, to see these very simplistic narratives about why people are coming or why they're not coming, because it is such a complex phenomenon, right? I mean, you don't migrate because of one reason. There are so many things that play into that decision. Right now, for example, we're seeing the fallout of the COVID crisis all over the world. And you know, that is affecting economies in Central America, that is affecting the economy in Mexico. So, you know, a little bit of it is that, a little bit of it is climate change. You know, there are climate change related agricultural failures and other issues that have been ongoing in some parts of, in Guatemala, for example, for a really long time. And then the third is, we have to also think about the fact that while the Biden administration has rolled back many of Trump's policies, one of the biggest ones at the border, border ban essentially, is still in place. It's called the Title 42 ban because it invokes this law that is a public health law, and it allows the administration to return or turn back anyone who comes to the border without letting them request asylum, essentially. Typically, what would have happened otherwise is that, you know, they go through the process, they request asylum, and then a judge decides whether or not they get it. And that, you know, then they stay or they don't stay. But now they are just being turned back right at the border itself without that process happening at all. So You know, so how does that affect this particular problem? Well, in the past, with restrictive policies like this, what's happened is that families who come to the border and are turned back will often send their kids to cross, you know, unaccompanied so that they are able to get some semblance of safety. We've seen this before with other policies, and increasingly advocates are pointing to this phenomenon, you know, sort of on an anecdotal basis, saying that this is also contributing to the rise in unaccompanied kids that we're seeing right now. So, you know, so it's really complicated. And often, you know, the conversation, you know, as Khadija said, it's going to be really, really politicized, and on both sides of the aisle often really reduces that complexity.
So we are in this greater context too, Khadija, of just how much effort, how much work the Biden administration has to do. Because immigration sounds like a simple enough issue, but it is a set of deeply complex systems, right? And a lot of the changes that Trump made to those systems were done through executive order or regulatory change. And there was a Yale professor, Lucas Gutentag, who maintained this online tracker during the Trump administration to basically note every immigration regulatory change that was pushed through during the entire administration. And there were over 1,000 small changes during that time. And another legacy on the other end of it is that the Trump administration filled 2/3 of the immigration court's judicial appointments. So there is a lot of work to do if Biden is to, you know, put in place the vision for immigration that he has. Is there unity among Democrats on what needs to be done or even where to begin, Khadija?
No, it's so crazy because it's not a new issue, right? So you would think there would be some similarity as to what the plan is. I think with the change in administration, that has a lot to do with it. What I'm hearing is that the administration is not being communicative with the members of Congress. So as we just talked about, there's 4 different CODELs going to the border, right? So, like, what is the plan? I was trying to get out of members what they actually are going to see or what they're looking for, right? Didn't really get an answer, but many of them said that this ultimately was going to become a fact-finding solution, right? Even though this is an age-old problem, right? But I think one of the important things is that they need to, I don't know, gather information from like the people on the ground, right? Because we don't hear a lot about that. And maybe not so much of the politics stuff. We have moderates who don't want portions of the comprehensive bill. We have border members of the members of Congress who like live on the border, who represent people on the border, who have a very different idea. And then we have like the Congressional Hispanic Caucus, who is like trying to push for a separate idea. So yeah, I would say that was a very long way to say I don't see that there is much unity, and they basically have to get it together.
Right. So this is where it gets stuffed, Hemvi, because there are big expectations for the Biden administration on immigration.
So why should voters trust you with an immigration overhaul now?
Because we made a mistake. It took too long to get it right. It took too long to get it right. I'll be president of the United States, not vice president of the United States. And the fact is,
have talked about it so much. They have, it's sort of a central part of their brand that they promise this, you know, humane system of immigration. Is it possible for them to put that in place?
So I think they can definitely make strides if they are going to be bold about it. And there's certainly been surprising steps that they've taken, honestly. You know, I've covered this under Obama and under Trump, and I was surprised with the enthusiasm and then the way that they were prioritizing these measures. A lot of them, however, were kind of measures that undo things, right? And the question is whether they can replace those things with new systems. They still can if the legislation fails, which, you know, it is very likely to fail, the comprehensive reform at least. They can still put in measures through regulatory and executive orders, as Trump did, as Obama did before him. It's just that then becomes a little bit more vulnerable to lawsuits, and what lawsuits do is just put those, you know, those impediments in the path of actually getting those things out there. We're seeing these unaccompanied kids at the border, and that's a very narrow sort of thing that, you know, as Kriya said, there's not really even consensus around that in the Democratic Party. And so I feel like even that, in that measure, in or the story around that issue, you can see that there is this sort of scramble, right, to kind of fulfill the promise of the rhetoric that they've put out, which is that there's going to be more, you know, it's going to be more humane and it's going to be no more kids in cages. But at the same time, in practice, they're having logistical and political doubts within their own camp about how that's going to work. And you can see that in the fact that there are more, they're reopening these influx shelters, which were highly criticized and have again been criticized by the more progressive bloc within the Democratic Party. And that they're now, there was reporting from BuzzFeed the other day, I believe it was over the weekend, about how they're thinking of turning back some of these kids under that previous policy that I mentioned, the border ban. Yeah. So you know, there's that like balancing act, which is, do we go as bold as we promised that we would, or should we sort of balance out that with a sort of political optics of seeming too permissible at the border? You know, they're always kind of thinking of the more moderate part of their base, and to some extent, how the Republican backlash is going to look like.
To that end, Kadia, I'm not sure that you can put the genie back in the bottle, right? Trump's really tough posture on immigration was so central to his campaign in 2016. This issue is not going to go away anytime soon. He didn't hit the immigration note as much in 2020, but it is a live issue, right? It's something that people will keep returning to mine sort of a wedge issue between parties. So how important do you think immigration will be politically over the next 4 years?
As of today, it will be super important, but this has been a very fickle Congress and executive branch, White House, so I can't quite put my finger on it. But, I mean, if you want to gauge a president on what his priorities are, announcing immigration reform in the first 100 days, I feel, is very telling as to how he'll be approaching it. But yeah, I think it'll be a significant factor. If not for Democrats who are trying to fix the issue, for Republicans who are going to run counter to the issue.
What that's telling us, Tanvi, is that we are in a moment where maybe the political priorities have been reordered by COVID-19. And basically, the minute that we started turning the corner on this, now that vaccines are getting in arms, now that there's more and more of a supply, perhaps America's returning to some of its foundational tensions of the moment, right? Like, immigration is an easy one. And it's like, oh, well, thank goodness we have that COVID-19 situation sorted. Let's get back to the tension that we had before, which was immigration. And I guess, like, are we bound to just repeat the cycle?
Yeah. You know, I would say that even during the COVID-19 crisis, I feel like immigration really did figure to a large extent in at least the Trump administration's spin, right? I mean, they tried to kind of externalize or other the crisis as something that was like foreigner brought, and you know, sort of blame foreigners for it and blame immigrants for it. That's why they implemented the border ban. I think that it is one of those tried and tested old playbooks that you know, surface time and again and bring up very fundamental tensions within sort of the American like idea, I guess, about yes, who belongs and who doesn't. And it's very easy to use that on both sides of the aisle. You know, like I said, particularly by Republicans, to sort of accuse Democrats of, you know, not putting Americans first. But yeah, I do think that there is this like sort of doomed cycle, you know, kind of repeating itself. That said, I am encouraged by some of the legislative strides, yes, in the two narrow bills that we're going to see this week, and we'll see how that goes. I think that will be really telling about the direction of that and whether there is a break in at least at least a temporary break in that cycle, but also in the level of grassroots activism around this issue. That's really been, I think that is to large extent what I would credit for pushing even the Biden administration to the extent that it has been pushed. I mean, I was really skeptical that they were even going to come this far because they are so concerned about trying to portray this image of themselves as being really, really balanced and moderate, which kind of figures, right? It's Joe Biden, that I was surprised that they even came this far. So I do think that that activism is even louder now, at least in the circles that I, you know, the conversations that I listen into and lurk around. And so that is another thing that I'm watching out for, because I do think it's going to keep pushing things a certain way.
As always, there's going to be more and more developments on this, and we will keep watching. Kadia Tenvi, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with us today.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you so much. This is fun.
And that is it for this week. Our guests were journalist Kadia Goba with Axios and freelance journalist Tenvi Misra. I'm your host, El Amin Abdul Mahmoud. I will see you on Thursday on the regular version of Party Lines with Rosemary Barton.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.